This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Can you recall who you were at the age of 16 or 17? How responsible were you for your actions back then? Remembering how we saw the world when we were in our mid-teens is a good place to start in considering international law specialist Mark Drumbel's new book. It might also be worth imagining how our sense of responsibility as teens could have been different if we'd grown up in Rwanda, Syria, or Sierra Leone instead of Middle America. If you're willing to consider such things, then Drumbel has a head start in his mission of persuading you that it's time to rethink attitudes toward child soldiers. Drumbel's main argument, one size does not fit all. So one universal approach to young people who fight in wars is not workable either. The book is titled Reimagining Child Soldiers, and it will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. What does the term child soldier bring to mind for you? A young boy in Liberia being forced to bear arms by a vicious warlord? Joan of Arc jumping atop her horse at the age of 16 and leading the French into battle? A 15-year-old Canadian-born youngster caught by American troops in Afghanistan and held at Guantanamo for almost 8 years before being convicted of killing a U.S. soldier? Or even a 15-year-old military cadet in Lexington, Virginia, picking up a gun and marching into battle with other Confederate fighters in America's Civil War? International justice scholar Mark Drumbel has decided to challenge all of us in general and the international justice community in particular to consider the possibility that child soldier does not mean the same thing in all circumstances. If you have thoughts on that or questions to offer, please do make note of our call-in number, 888-WMRA-TALK. That translates to 888-967-2825. Mr. Drumbel has served as a defense attorney for soldiers accused of war crimes in Rwanda and worked as part of a team investigating war crimes in Somalia. He is currently a professor of law at Washington and Lee University, as well as director of that school's Transnational Law Institute. His newest book is titled Reimagining Child Soldiers. Mark, welcome back to the Insight Studios.
Thank you, Tom. It's a joy to be here.
Well, so good to see you again. But I guess the main thing I need to ask you is, what do you want us to reimagine about soldiers who are children?
Well, what I want to reimagine is the way in which international law and policy currently portrays child soldiers. And I would suspect that the projection of law and policy that resonates with most people is of the child soldier as very young, a boy, who is presented as a faultless passive victim. In other words, a boy that demonstrates very little to no involvement in how he ended up in fighting forces, and also how and why he committed actions while part of fighting forces. I emphasize the boy because that in and of itself is somewhat misleading. Approximately 40% of all child soldiers worldwide are actually girls.
40%?
40%, yes. And that is...
But that also begs the question of how you're defining child soldier, because if I recall what I've read of your book, Mark, many of those girls are not actually fighting forces.
You've put your finger on an important aspect. International law and policy defines child soldiers in the following sense. Any person under the age of 18 who is associated with armed forces or armed groups. It's an extremely broad definition that covers a broad variety of activities and people. So, for example, a child carrying weapons serving as a combatant counts as a child soldier. So too does a porter, a spy, a sex slave, a domestic worker. So too are children who are born into armed forces or armed groups, often with child mothers. So the definition is extremely broad. One of the reasons the definition is broad is to protect as many persons or children as possible.
Who makes the definitions?
Well, the definition that I'm relying my work on here is comes from an agreement called the Paris Principles, which is from 2007, which is a set of principles that a broad number of states have endorsed. And that definition of child soldiering also has emerged in previous and earlier policy documents and is now beginning to work its way into our legal understanding.
Is it basically also now the United Nations working understanding?
Yes. One of the major supporters of this definition of child soldiers are the United Nations and also a broad community of non-governmental organizations, human rights activists, and so forth. And in my book, I call this particular group the international legal imagination. They're a broad variety of actors that help define the problem, namely child soldiering, and then help mobilize a lot of resources and funds in order to try and combat it. But let me go back to then what the international legal imagination has created, which is this image of the child soldier as a faultless passive victim. Now, undoubtedly, there are a large number of child soldiers who are very young and who are abducted, who are coerced, who are brutalized, and who have very little say in what actually happens to them in times of conflict. But the actual social realities of child soldiering are much more complicated. For example, your listeners may be surprised to learn that roughly two-thirds of all child soldiers actually exercise some initiative, at times considerable initiative, in joining armed forces or armed groups. And in this regard, when you think of the child soldier only as a faultless passive victim, what you don't fully appreciate, understand, or deal with is the reality of youth volunteerism.
And the vast majority of those are 15, 16, 17, which even in our society, we don't necessarily equate with the word child.
Correct. You're absolutely right. The vast majority of child soldiers are teenagers, often older child soldiers. In reality, the problem of child soldiering is actually the problem of adolescent soldiering, if you're going to look at the largest number. And what the international legal imagination has done, it's very well intended, but it has naturalized or normalized the extremes. What it's done is it's created an image based on the youngest child soldiers and the most difficult and painful cases, and those children require protection. But it's just not necessarily in the best interests of all child soldiers to view the problem as definable only by the extremes.
Now, you're not denying, Mark Drumble, that there have been cases of children as young as 9 or 8 or even 7 in places like the civil wars in Liberia and Rwanda, being forced by battle commanders, being abducted from their homes and forced to carry guns and forced to shoot at the quote-unquote enemy. Some of that has actually happened. It's just what you're saying is that the perception is overblown?
No, I'm just saying that example, you can't inductively reason from the most extreme example to try and prevent child soldiering as a whole. Let me give you another important piece of data that your listeners may find surprising. In situations of conflict, even atrocity-producing conflicts, only a small percentage of child soldiers actually commit serious international crimes, whether they're forced to or not. Let's put that question to the side. But in terms of the numbers of child soldiers that actually commit these particular offenses or put in these horrible situations, it's actually only a small percentage. The vast majority of child soldiers, they're porters, they carry things, and they serve auxiliary functions for armed forces and armed groups. Now, that means they're exposed to great peril and they're exposed to great danger, but they aren't necessarily the kinds of child soldiers that are going to be implicated after the conflict in a conversation about justice.
Mark Drumble, I can imagine that there's at least one person listening who's saying to themselves, you know, I never imagine anything about child soldiers unless I maybe read some horror story about young children being forced to fight. But this whole idea of recreating our image of what it means to be a child soldier and how that relates to international justice sounds to me like just something that a bunch of lawyers somewhere at some UN conference would talk about. Well, why should I care? And I think in your book, you identify some very real reasons for caring, including the whole effort that you've been part of in different places in the world to reintegrate young people after a combat ends, after a war ends, into society. And one of the arguments that you're making is if you're going to take these people who were soldiering at a fairly young age, some of whom either actually committed or were feared to have committed atrocities, and try and build a bridge to reconciliation, you can't simply imagine every child soldier as equal in rights and in actions?
That's correct. Nor can you necessarily assume all child soldiers as entirely lacking responsibility, involvement, or agency with regards to what they did during conflict. So I'm writing this book for three reasons. I have three main goals. One is for the international community more effectively to prevent and deter and stop child soldiering. And I would argue that you can't achieve those goals without accurately understanding the nuance and subtlety and complexity of the problem. Second, I'm writing this book so that former child soldiers can be more effectively reintegrated, rehabilitated, and in a sense, put on a road to becoming productive members of society after conflict. The only way to achieve that, in my opinion, is to recognize the different experience of child soldiers during conflict and tailor reintegrative policies to them as individuals. And in the case of children who have been involved in the commission of systematic atrocities, the best way to reintegrate those children, in my opinion, after conflict is to have some kind of a justice conversation. It doesn't mean criminal trials. It means their participation in restorative or ceremonial justice mechanisms, truth and reconciliation commissions, in a way that is accurate. And an accurate depiction means understanding those children as victims, as witnesses, and potentially as perpetrators.
In fact, as an international justice attorney who's participated in war crimes tribunals, you're flat out opposed to anyone under the age of 17 being put on trial.
Yes. My reasons for that, though, don't have to do with age or chronology. They have to do with experiences that I've had in my prior work, for example, in Rwanda, where I am just skeptical in general of the ability of retributive criminal trials to create reconciliation and social repair after conflict outside of the context of the most senior leaders. But let me go back to my third reason for writing this book. And my third reason is I'm committed to creating a robust and rich culture of juvenile rights. And in my opinion, the only way to create a rich culture of juvenile rights is to recognize that with rights come responsibility. And treating an entire segment of the population, namely as under the age of 18, as unable to exercise any agency, action, discretion, or judgment, even in situations of conflict, I think lays a very weak foundation afterwards for youth to be taken seriously in terms of rebuilding societies after conflict. When an entire group of individuals is deemed non-responsible, I don't think that lays a strong foundation to embolden a culture of the rights of the child or of the rights of youth.
So a question for you who are listening. What was your reaction when you first learned that U.S. troops had captured a 15-year-old in Afghanistan, charged him with participating in a firefight against American forces, and shipped him off to Guantanamo, kept him imprisoned there for almost 8 years without trial? And did that reaction change at all when last year, now at the age of 23, the young man pleaded guilty to all charges against him? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Mark Drumbel, there is some dichotomy in U.S. policy, and we're going to ask you about that in 1 minute. Mark Drumbel has clerked for the Supreme Court of Canada, worked with war crimes defendants in Rwanda, been part of a team investigating military wrongdoing in Somalia, as well as served on law school faculties at Vanderbilt University, Columbia University, and the University of Arkansas. Today, he is a professor of law at Washington and Lee University and serves as director of that school's Transnational Law Institute. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Mark Drumbel's new book, by the way, coming out near the beginning of next year, so I should say forthcoming new book, is titled Reimagining Child Soldiers. And one of the things that you note, Mark Drumbel, is that U.S. policy towards who is a child soldier and what the response to a young person who's a soldier should be is kind of situational.
Mm-hmm. So there's a major gap that has emerged, and that is this. Under international law, so for example, the International Criminal Tribunals, the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, these institutions absorb the international policy of approaching child soldiers as not the kinds of individuals that ought to be criminally prosecuted for involvement in atrocity because of their age. In the United States, however, the domestic approach is much more equivocal. And we have scenarios that have emerged, such as Omar Khadr. Moreover, one of the Somali pirates that was recently convicted in New York for an attack on an American ship, he alleged in his defense that he was a teenager at the time, and the court completely dismissed that either as being relevant to guilt or innocence or to sentence. So what we have is the following. The centers of global power view the child soldier as an innocent, faultless victim when that child soldier is involved in committing terrible crimes against populations that are located outside the center of global politics. So in other words, when children are involved in committing crimes in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. However, when a person under the age of 18, for example, acts as a terrorist or a suicide bomber or as someone who is involved with Al-Qaeda and commits violence against Western interests, that person is not seen as a purposeless or deluded child, but rather is seen as a menacing and purposeful adult and is criminally prosecuted accordingly if the person survives after having committed the attack. And at the end of the day, for me, this presents a very troubling dichotomy. The status of a defendant or the status of someone who commits a crime should not hinge on the nationality of the victims. So to me, this suggests the following. How do we avoid this double standard? Well, I'll tell you how we avoid the double standard. We avoid it by simply having a more subtle, sublime, nuanced appreciation of children in conflict as opposed to adopting these extremist images. On the one hand, faultless passive victimhood, or on the other hand, what comes up in the terrorist context, namely teenage terrorists as, you know, as demons, as bandits, as irredeemable, and as deserving of the most severe punishment. At the end of the day, Omar Khadr's patterns of socialization.
And we ought to explain. Omar Khadr is the person that I referred to just during the break, although I didn't mention him by name. At the time of the incident in, I believe it was Western Afghanistan, his family was living in Pakistan, he was in a village where U.S. troops were doing some kind of investigation. They came upon reason to suspect that there might be a terrorist cell in one particular house that they had not originally intended to investigate. They went to investigate. There was a firefight. Most of the Afghanis inside that house were killed. stashes of weapons were found there. And they also found this 15-year-old boy, I think it's probably okay to call him a boy, who was the only survivor after the house had been bombed. He had been shot twice by U.S. soldiers. One of the U.S. soldiers who was injured in that firefight, I think it was Sergeant Spear, later died. And the 15-year-old, Omar Khadr, was taken into custody by U.S. troops, given some medical attention, shortly afterward shipped to Guantanamo Bay and incarcerated there, continuing to get medical attention, stayed there for almost 8 years before he was brought to trial. He's a Canadian citizen. He was born in Canada, although his family had connections to Pakistan. Some of the international community had been outraged, one, that someone so young would be put in isolation in a place like Guantanamo, especially without charges being brought for several years, or that the Canadian government didn't have rights to this young man. But as you say, U.S. policy seems to be when it's what's considered to be a terrorist action, there's a different set of standards. Is there a legitimate, do you see both sides here?
Well, I see both sides, and I think the solution is to look at it in the middle, which is that let's avoid these extremes. Let's recognize that the path that Omar Khadr took to being a child soldier is not necessarily all that different than the pattern that other children follow to child soldiering in other jurisdictions. And it's just important for us to have a consistent approach. And, you know, let's just not pick on the United States as a bogeyman in this particular context. You know, the Canadian government did not bend over backwards to get Omar Khadr back home. And now Canada has concluded a diplomatic agreement with the United States. And following service of his what's left in his sentence, Khadr will come back to Canada. And by the operation, as I understand them, of national law in Canada, he then would be released, but he's served an awful lot of time already for his involvement in this attack, in which he's alleged to have thrown a grenade, as you pointed out, that killed this American service member. But I think the broader lesson for us to take away from all of this is the extent to which we fail to appreciate the individual diversity in youth militarization fails, I think, us, because we fail to recognize that the process of reconstruction of societies after the fact is not only a collective process, it's a process of the best way forward for individuals and their own individual situations. And every time the law draws a bright line, what it ends up doing, I think, is unfairly disadvantaging some people and unfairly advantaging others. So let me give you another example. In my work in Rwanda, I had a number of clients who were, for example, 16 or 17 at the time they were alleged to have committed crimes of genocide.
Back up a little bit, if you would, Mark Jumble, especially for anybody who's just joined us, and tell us a little bit about how you ended up in Rwanda and what your work there was.
In the late 1990s, the Rwandan genocide happened in 1994, and in the late 1990s, there was a complete crush of individuals in the prisons in Rwanda accused of genocide. At some points, there were well over 100,000 individuals detained in facilities that could probably adequately house maybe at most a fifth of that number. So along with a group of other American lawyers, I worked for a not-for-profit in Rwanda that helped match, for example, individuals in prison with the charges that were brought against them, in a sense.
So you ended up acting as a defense attorney for people accused of war crimes.
Yeah, not a defense attorney in the sense that your listeners might conceive of in the United States. It was really more a case of, you know, where's this person? What are the charges against him? Can we even bring this person to some kind of a trial, right? But in that context, I had the opportunity to work with a couple of hundred clients. And I personally found that the ones who were teenagers at the time they were alleged to have committed the crimes and the ones that were in their early 20s, I did not see material differences between them.
And you had clients who were as young as 15 or 16 when they were alleged to have committed crimes.
Yes. In fact, I even had some that were still youth at the time I was there. So they would have been about 13 or 14 when they were alleged to have committed the crimes. But when the law focuses so much on the age of 18, it comes down very lightly on those who are younger than 18. And I would say it excessively infantilizes that group. But Tom, let me tell you, it means the law comes down very, very hard on the 19-year-old, the 20-year-old, the 21-year-old, notwithstanding the reality that we know from neuroscientific evidence and neurobiological evidence that the brain, the emotions, and impulse control don't suddenly stop at 18. They continue to develop and grow after that. And I think we have this real problem in the application of international criminal law that it comes down very harshly on an age group just over this demographic hump. But then unnaturally, it treads too lightly, I think, on the group that's younger than that.
So for you who are listening, the U.S. Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, even the so-called Arab Spring and the rebellion against tyranny in Libya, there are many places where many of us has had a positive reaction when we've seen or read about young people fighting for what they believe in. Is it reasonable to automatically have a negative reaction when the cause for which a teenager is fighting is one with which we disagree? Or is there something else at play here? 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number, 888-967-2825. If you'd like to join the conversation with international justice specialist Mark Drumble, and if you'd prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed at WMRA's Virginia Insight. All of our phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK at this precise moment. Mark, you mentioned that, much to the surprise of people who don't track these type of things, when you use the term child soldier, as it is currently defined by international justice organizations, including the United Nations, 40% of that population is made up of females.
Yes.
Many of those are certainly victims. I mean, those who are forced at the age of 12 or 14 or even 17 to be acting as sex slaves for commanding officers, those who are forced into labor cleaning or cooking or whatever their responsibility is. Some of them are also carrying guns, and I guess some of them do it of their own volition. Is it any harder at the end of a conflict for any of those young women or girls to reintegrate into their societies than it is for the boys?
Well, that's an excellent question. When you look at survey data coming out of societies where there has been child soldiering and conflicts have ended, girl soldiers do face serious hurdles in reintegration. The vast majority of girl soldiers in many conflicts are subject to terrible sexual violence and rape. Many of them may have children that are born during the conflict that are the products of either sexual violence or forced marriage, both of which obviously are international crimes. There are also a small number of girl soldiers who do participate as combatants. The percentage of girls who serve as combatants is smaller than that of boys who serve in that particular function. So I would argue that efforts to reintegrate child soldiers that treat all child soldiers as an indistinguishable part of a generic category actually ill serve those former child soldiers who have often suffered the most and have some of the most serious reintegration challenges, such as girl soldiers. And let's also be very honest about something. Girl soldiers are victimized not only by adult commanders. Many girl soldiers are victimized by boy soldiers. And when the entire group of child soldiers are viewed as indistinguishable, those details are lost. Let me tell you another narrative that's lost when all child soldiers are viewed as faultless, innocent, passive victims. Many children in situations of conflict demonstrate tremendous tenacity, enterprise, courage, and will in refusing to commit acts of violence or in engaging in subterfuge to subvert orders of their commanders. The resilience of children in times of conflict is really overwhelming and is something that current discourse and conversation, I don't think, highlights sufficiently. But highlighting someone's resilience and courage and refusal may necessarily mean placing that in contrast with another teenager's decision to exceed cruel orders or to use violence as a way of acquiring more status or more position in very volatile situations of armed groups. I also think, going back to the question you had asked earlier about which groups of child soldiers face serious challenges on reintegration, obviously girl soldiers are one. Yet another group that faces challenges are that small subset of child soldiers that local communities know are either implicated with units that during the conflict have committed systematic atrocity, or children who have been associated with such units for a very long period of time. And I argue in the book that that particular subset of child soldiers would best be served. It is in their best interests to be reintegrated and reconciled for them to participate in some kind of justice process other than criminal trials. And at the end of the day, I think it's important for us to recognize the diversity in the group. Your listeners may be surprised, Tom, with another important piece of data. How do child soldiers exit conflict? I've told you earlier that in terms of how they enter conflict, a larger percentage enter through sort of some form of volunteerism, and then they're enlisted, than are abducted or forced. But let's think of exit. And as it turns out, the vast majority of child soldiers in situations of conflict exit armed groups not because they're captured, not because they're rescued by international humanitarians. They exit because they just leave. They either escape or they abandon the group. And at the end of the day, they demonstrate agency and volition and often great courage in doing that. So I think we just need to understand the multiplicity of experience, the different rate at which individuals develop and exercise choice. And let me go back to...
Before you do.
Sure.
You hear the music. We're going to hit the break in just a few moments. There is a place in your book where you talk about the fact that you were doing much of the writing while you were on sabbatical in Australia. And you were also doing some teaching there. And every day on your way to the local university, you would walk past a statue, and a little bit later you'd walk past a mural with sort of opposite images that say a lot about what we, our cognitive dissonance about this issue. We'll get to that in a moment. You do have Virginia Insight on your radio or streaming online at WMRA.org. Somewhere in our audience is someone who left home in their mid-teens, lied about their age, and managed to enlist in the military while younger than they legally should have been allowed to do such a thing. If you are that person and you'd be willing to tell us about your experience, please do call 888-WMRA-TALK. Or maybe the scenario I just mentioned wasn't your story specifically, but you know of someone, a family member or close friend who had that experience. We're looking for as much perspective as possible today at what most people consider to be underage soldiering. 888-967-2825 is our phone number. Our guest, International War Crimes Tribunal expert Mark Drumble. His new book is titled Reimagining Child Soldiers, a book written in large part while you were in Melbourne, Australia, and having this interesting visual dichotomy on your daily walk.
Right. So when I left our apartment, I would walk a couple of blocks and I would walk past the State Library of Victoria. And outside the State Library of Victoria is a sculpture of Joan of Arc on horseback. And she is poised and taut and proud with a stoic look on her face and her, we would say in French, her oriflamme, that's sort of like her a weaponry at the end of which is a flag, is raised up in the air. And she radiates a sense of pride and a sense of confidence. And then you walk a few blocks further and you'd pass, at least I did, the Australian Red Cross building. And on the wall of that, as part of their incredibly important campaign to end child soldiering, is a mural of a very young boy in shorts and in short sleeves. One sock has fallen down, the other is pulled up. He is barely able to carry an AK-47 that's strapped across his shoulders, and he is entirely succumbing to the weight of this weaponry, and he radiates at an image of desolation, emptiness, and embarrassment. And to me, these two pieces of public art represent, in many ways, the trajectory of the child soldier in international law and policy, which is from the possibility of some martial pride to the absolute patheticness of an absence of any kind of pride. And in either case, these are extreme images. But once again, what's lost is this middle ground. And what I want to emphasize to you is the life of the child soldier today is extremely brutal. It's harsh. The environments in which these children often fight are absolutely appalling. And in no way is the intent or the goal of this work to minimize that. But what it is to recognize the humanity of the children who are caught up in this situation, to recognize the diversity of experience. It's not to encase their vulnerability, but is to build on their strengths and their resilience. And I find that a lot of the international imagery really flattens that. Let me give you another image.
Before you do, let me ask you about the dichotomy that you just talked about between the statue of Joan of Arc and then the mural at the Red Cross portraying a modern-day child soldier as beleaguered victim. Is it possible that the part of what the difference there is, I mean, when Joan of Arc was in the middle of the Hundred Years' War against, well, fighting for the French, leading French troops, this was hundreds of years ago at the age of 16, 17, 18, 19, when most historians think she was finally burned at the stake. The mural that you were talking about portrays a modern-day child soldier. Is part of what's going on here simply that today we think of 16 being much more infantile than we did 200 or 300 or 400 years ago?
Well, I think that's certainly the case. I also think that one of the problems is the international law definition of the child soldier is under the age of 18 may transpose awkwardly to societies where, for example, half the population is under the age of 15. And many conflict societies are actually have this kind of demography. So that's a very interesting point. The chronology also may reflect and transpose poorly to societies where becoming an adult isn't just a matter of the passage of time, but it relates to experience, station in life, the kinds of behaviors you engage in, the kinds of rites of initiation that you've gone through. But let me go back to your original point here of, you know, then and now. But even now, we have visions of youth and politics and militarization that are more complicated. So, for example, the face of the Arab Spring was a very youthful face. The face of the Palestinian Intifada was a youthful face. The movement against apartheid in South Africa was in large part animated by township youth, many in their teens, who demonstrated incredible courage in overcoming and fighting oppression. And in certain contexts, that can painfully and tragically mean sliding into situations of armed conflict.
So is part of it that a 15 or 16 or 17-year-old who participated in the Arab Spring, or even 30 or 40 years ago in the civil rights movement, we can see that as a positive thing because we agree with those actions?
That's one potential interpretation. And I'm really grateful that you brought up our own civil rights movement. The Children's March in Birmingham, Alabama, for example, was controversial at the time, but also revealed, I think, the moral commitment to desegregation. And now, if you go to Birmingham, you go to Kelly Ingram Park in the downtown area of the city, there are sculptures that commemorate the Children's March. And they depict the involved children with incredible dignity, a courage in the very best traditions of civil disobedience and of the political demonstrator, the nonviolent political demonstrator.
As far as a soldier, though, is considered, Mark Drumbel, is there any place in the world today where it should be okay for a 15-year-old to enlist in an army or in a war effort and carry a gun and kill the enemy?
At present, when it comes to practice, the vast majority of countries have adopted 18 as the minimum age of voluntary enlistment into national armed forces. There are some countries that permit enlistment at the ages of 17 or even 16. And quite a large
including
number.
Including the U.S., 17, yeah, if you have a parent sign.
Yes, and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and Germany and France. There's quite a number of large number of Western countries. And as you correctly point out, that has to be with consent. But don't get me wrong. In Sierra Leone, many children joined an organization called the CDF that existed to defend the completely beleaguered democratic government of Sierra Leone from rebel activities. The CDF enlisted child soldiers, and many of those child soldiers volunteered on their own to fight with parental consent as well.
So we're looking at how you want things to change, Mark, based on a couple decades of experience, both as an attorney looking and researching international law and actually acting as a defense attorney or investigator in war crimes tribunals. From your point of view, is it ever appropriate to allow a 15-year-old to become a soldier of his or her own volition?
I would say no. And the purpose of this book is not to set an arbitrary chronological age on when you can become a soldier or not. But if I had to say, I would say that the current push towards 18 as the age of enlistment is perfectly acceptable and perfectly appropriate and something that I would support.
So a large part of what you're trying to do in this book, and you've mentioned a couple of times in the past hour, is to create a more nuanced view of what it means to be a child soldier and what level of responsibility we should hold a young person to if they are accused of atrocities while acting in a war. That being the case, why is this so difficult to persuade the international justice community that it's a good idea?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. There is a very well-intended international lobbying effort that associates the protection of the rights of the child with, in the context of violence, for example, notions that children should not really be held accountable or held responsible for those particular acts. I said earlier I was going to give you another image, and I think this image, in my opinion, really captures well this particular thinking. One major not-for-profit group that has been very successful in mobilizing considerable public outrage upon child soldiering uses an image of a Crayola crayon box, and instead of crayons in the box, there are bullets in the box. And clearly the impression that's given here is that child soldiering is about those kinds of very young kids who draw things with crayons, as opposed to the reality of adolescent soldiering. But my main goal in writing this book is to
recognize... my question was, why is there so much opposition to the nuanced approach that you're arguing for compared to the absolutist approach that seems to predominate in international justice today? It sounds like one of the things that you're saying is that some people are just so sold on the idea of protecting children at any cost that we're not willing to consider any nuance for anyone under the age of 18. Is that the answer?
Yes, and I would say it's coupled with a very understandable sense of fear. Fear that once the absolutism of the imagery cracks, you're going to have realities of criminal prosecutions for teenagers, very hard sentencing. You're going to have kids who have become involved in these terrible situations held excessively accountable for what they actually did. I think it's fear. The human rights community is concerned that if there's a little crack, floodgates open, and you're going to have a very wretched situation for these kids.
So, Mark Trumbo, we're running short on time, and part of what we want to get to here also is why you're concerned about this and what you want the end result to be. One of the things that you've pushed for in your work around the world is reconciliation efforts. What needs to be done to encourage reconciliation? Whether we're talking about a 15 or 16-year-old child soldier who committed atrocities in Liberia or Rwanda, or a 15 or 16-year-old who's accused of an atrocious crime in the U.S. Is there a difference?
Well, I would say there's a difference in that children who are involved in soldiering often are implicated in environments that are much more difficult. But let me say why this is important for reconciliation. The reality is that in situations of conflict, children will become abused and victimized, and in turn, some of them will abuse and victimize others. You can't avoid that. You can't wish that away, and you can't legislate it away. I wish we could, but I don't think that's going to be possible. So the question then becomes, how do you best move individuals who've been involved in that out of the past and into a healthy future? And I believe that to say that all children who are involved in those situations, all adolescents who are implicated in that, should be excused is not the way forward. It's not durable. The better way to create reconciliation.
It's not durable?
Yeah, it's not a durable form of peace. Like, it's not strong. It's not going to last.
Durable.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I
thought that was an attorney word about jury and durable. No. Well, I misheard. I apologize.
It's just not going to hold, right? And I believe in order for us to achieve a much more long-lasting peace, it is going to oblige us to recognize that victims also can victimize. And when we think of reconciliation, we have to think much more actively of things like truth and reconciliation commissions, community service, traditional ceremonies. And how we involve youth in those can be both empowering. And there's one constituency we haven't talked about here at all. And that constituency are third parties who tragically have suffered terrible harm at the hands of youth or children in situations of conflict. And they, too, I believe, require more in order to achieve a sense of justice than to simply be told that the perpetrator was not responsible entirely because of age. And I have confidence in local communities. I'm not fearful, and I address this at the end of my book, I'm not fearful or scared that a more nuanced and realistic picture is going to lead to a floodgates where child soldiers become re-abused.
And I'm sorry that we're out of time, because you mentioned something very important that also comes up in your book, the degree to which the international community ought to be trusting local communities and not trying to impose its view from on high.
And I agree, and I think that's also an important part of the overall equation.
Our guest has been Mark Drumbel, a professor of law and director of the Transnational Law Institute at Washington and Lee University. His forthcoming new book is titled Reimagining Child Soldiers. Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you do go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work that Mr. Drumbel is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.